This podcast is a free service from FX Guide. If you want to help contribute to FX Guide, consider becoming an insider supporter. Look for the link on the homepage at the top. We also want to flag to you the upcoming FX Guide Live event on Tuesday of NAB, April 9th, between 10 and 4. And it's going to be repeated right after at fxguide.com. If you're in Vegas, come down and visit us at the Foundry booth on Tuesday. And if you can't make us, of course, you can watch us live, thanks to our primary sponsor, The Foundry, with help from Blackmagic cameras, Miller tripods, Rode audio, and wooden camera supports. Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show, where we are going, well, I was going to say back to Oz. We're going to Oz for the first time. Oz the Great and Powerful, the prequel to The Great Wizard of Oz. I'm joined by some European hosts as we swing the show culturally to that side of the Atlantic. And joining me, first of all, is Matt Leonard. How are you, Matt?
Very well, thank you. Great to be on the show.
And my good friend, Zap Anderson. How are you, sir?
I'm awesome, as always.
So, guys, we're going to discuss, obviously, the VFX of the show, as we tend to do. Let's start out with the film, and it's been remarkably successful, even more successful, I think, than most people might have imagined. It certainly struck a chord for audiences at the box office. Did it strike a chord for you guys creatively, Zap? Did you enjoy the film?
The thing is, you might know that there was a plan for this film to star Robert Downey Jr. And every time I look at, James Franco doing stuff, I keep seeing the better version in my head with Robert Downey Jr. in it doing the same thing. So that, you know, took it down a few notches for me. So I cannot say that I love this movie. It was an okay movie. It was not a bad movie, but it didn't tickle all my fancies for story-wise. I think they kind of dragged on in the beginning with the cancer sequence. It was a little tad too long, and it tried to be too clever for its own good in tiny parts. But, I mean, it was okay. The visual stuff we'll get to later, you know, is a different story. But as a story-wise, not a super fan.
So, Matt, $215 million of production budget later. Did you enjoy it?
I did. I wouldn't say it was my favorite Sam Raimi movie, but I did enjoy it. I went to see it with my daughter, and she really enjoyed it. So I wouldn't say it would have been the best movie I've seen, but it definitely wasn't by any means the worst. So... yeah, I definitely enjoyed it.
The American Public Broadcasting Fresh Air program had their reviewer review it, and he summed it up really well for me. He said that, and it's basically echoing your remarks, Zap, that there was this kind of cool, hip indifference thing that Franco seemed to be going for that almost made you look like he didn't want to be there or he was kind of awkward. He was almost playing it as if he was doing that... sort of detached kind of hip thing that you can get away with maybe with a couple of actors, you know, but certainly he wasn't kind of carrying it so well. So you had this sort of look of him neither committing totally to the role nor looking like he was, you know, cocky enough to get away with sort of not committing to the role. So it almost felt like he was a tad kind of not in his comfort zone and not even... yeah. Cool about being on a kind of fantasy kidsy kind of film. And I gotta say that had echoes to me of the Oscars when he was co-hosting. I kind of like him as a guy. I just don't like him in this kind of a film, and certainly from a Sam Raimi point of view, I think much better Sam Raimi films than this. So I would agree with you guys that it was not a great film. It was, you know, not bad, but it just didn't really knock it out of the park. And apart from anything else, you know, it kind of didn't have that bigger plot hook for me. I mean, he was going to go to Oz and he was going to end up as the Great Oz. Okay.
Exactly. You always have this problem with prequels that you know exactly where it ends up. And you also, in this one, has the problem that you can't kill off any of the bad guys unless you do the Hobbit thing and introduce a new bad guy just to be able to have something you kill off, because we all know that the Wicked Witch of the insert, you know, direction here is still there in the actual Oz movie. So, yeah.
I've got to say, the other thing, I need to sort of pick up on a point you made before. I actually found the stuff in Kansas sort of probably more interesting than anything else, because that was stuff that I didn't know what was going to happen. And I sort of, it was really interesting being in black and white. And there was like lots of aspects about that that I found way more interesting plot-wise than almost anything that happened in Oz. The only exception to that is the very end. You know, like, how are they going to pull off taking back the city once it actually got into that action piece at the very end? I found that good. But there was a huge middle part where, plot-wise, it was just lame. And I've seen writers come up with stuff that's way cleverer than I could have thought of, that's made me go, oh, my God, that was just so brilliant. And it felt like this wasn't the case here. It's like, oh, well, I got to come up with that, and I'm not a writer. I want somebody better than me to come up with plots, because that one was one I could see coming.
It's funny you should say that, because for me, I think the movie kind of started when he met the little China girl. That was kind of where it, like, okay, now it starts to get a little bit interesting, because we have an actual character in the movie for the first time, which hasn't happened yet. By the way, a detail on the black and white sequence in the beginning. Are music boxes really that cheap if he was a penniless magician? He was giving them out left, right, and center. I don't know. Just a thought.
Okay. Hey, so let's swing now to the visual effects. You mentioned the China girl there. I'm going to say, and I'm pretty sure I can do this without risk of being contradicted, that the standout visual effects of the entire film was the China girl. She was rendered beautifully, she was executed exquisitely, and she came with a really great on-set reference from the puppeteer that stood in and puppeted an actual kind of China girl doll so that the actors could have something to work with. And I'm going to go out here and say I'm almost 100% sure you guys are going to agree with me, Matt.
Yeah, that she was definitely the nicest character in the whole film, and the thing that whenever she was on screen just brought life to what could have been quite a dull ride, as you've both said. Yeah, she looked lovely, and I think having, as you said, the puppeteer, I think his name was Philip Hubbard or something like that. I think having his performance with the live puppet and then having ImageWorks copy that really brought something extra, because whenever you looked at her, she looked like a puppet marionette, and I think just having that reference, as you said, from the set has really helped to bring that alive.
Yeah, I actually got to speak to Philip, the puppeteer, because we were doing press for this, and we were speaking to Sony about the great work that they were doing in terms of China Girl, and they started discussing. And when I realized that this was the same puppeteer that did the puppet sequences in Being John Malkovich, I really sort of flipped into overdrive and thought, oh, we've just got to speak to him. Now, do you guys see, I presume you did, Being John Malkovich?
Yeah, I remember it being very strange, but I did see it, yes.
Zam?
Way too long ago to actually, and don't hit me now, remember any puppets in it. Sorry.
So that's right. The main character is actually a puppeteer, and there's a sequence that is...
Oh, right, he is a puppeteer, mm-hmm. Right? Yeah. Okay, I remember now, yes.
And there's
a
sequence where he's busking on the street, and he basically produces a serious performance from a puppet, a dramatic performance. There are actually two puppets, either side of a wall, sort of like a love story. It's not played for laughs. It's not played for gags. It's certainly not Punch and Judy kind of stuff. And I remember at the time just going, oh, my God, this is like... just a completely naive view I have of puppetry. Of course you could do something serious, because I know that you can do great puppetry work with, and the Muppeteers do spectacular work, but all of that work in my head always ended up with a character that was somehow endearing and kind of cute, be it Yoda or be it Kermit. And this guy was doing work, and of course he was actually, Philip was actually puppeteering what the character in the film would look like he was doing. And And it was producing a dramatic performance. And I was like, that is just incredible. And at the time, he had a lot of positive press from other people that did puppeting work, saying, thank the Lord that someone's actually produced a character, a person in a film who does serious work with puppets and isn't a joke and isn't doing kids' stuff and isn't just a clown. And, we sort of have never had on screen somebody being taken seriously for doing puppetry work. When in other cultures like Indonesia, Japan, lots of other cultures, there's a great tradition of very serious puppeteering work and really wonderful shadow puppets and all this kind of stuff. So anyway, we got to speak to him, long story. And man, it was just interesting. And that's in an audio podcast over on FX Guide if you want to listen to parts of that interview. But I was fascinated to talk to him, as I was to see the behind-the-scenes footage, which we've also included on FX Guide, some B-roll from on set of him just, in a blue suit, of course, working the puppet. And yeah, when you see that and then you see the character in the film, obviously digitally rendered by the guys at Sony, you can just totally see where they've pulled it from. It's remarkable. So remarkable, in fact, that the director actually considered using the actual China doll puppet as the character in the film and having the strings digitally removed, though that proved to be impossible. I think that the way it works, of course, is there's like such a great one-to-one correlation, as you said, Matt. Like, you want the China girl to move like a puppet, and so if they're copying an actual puppet, you just get a heck of a lot of realism. And I thought she was magical. But Zap, can I ask you about the rendering? Because I also thought she looked really good.
Yes, it looked fantastic. And I must say, to your previous point about the performance, it is so interesting what you can do already with a puppet, because you can play with angles of the head. You perceive a fixed facial expression shown in different angles. You kind of perceive that as, more angry or more sad, depending how you tilt your head. But the rendering on this was just exquisite. I have a tiny little nitpick on the rendering, and it's so tiny, so please take it for how tiny it is. And it was this thing, if you remember the original Tin Toy film Pixar did, mm-hmm. where he has this incessant little window reflection on him, which doesn't make any sense because it doesn't match the window. He's actually in the room, but it's still almost like this cartoony. And she had kind of that. There was this one little reflection of like a white light card thingy that in certain shots, I was kind of doubting that was actual, reference from the on scene. They kind of liked this little pink highlight on her and kept it on all the time because it didn't really matter where she was, what the lighting situation was. There was this one little reflection all the time. And you have to be a complete rendering nerd like myself and actually think in these terms to even recognize this and even care. But or maybe I wouldn't say I cared. It looked beautiful anyway. But still, I saw this and realized that this lighting, while beautiful and it blends into the scene beautiful, it still kind of seems to not make complete sense to the lighting that should be there if they were shooting it out by on this road or whatever. But I mean, that's such a tiny little thing, and the beauty of it, the details, the little cracks in the porcelain, it's just, it was fantastic.
I gotta say, that crazing, I would call it crazing, in the porcelain, that cracking that you're referring to, that and the specular highlights are the two things that were really driving it for me. I know what you're saying about the spec highlights not necessarily being right, but I totally forgave them because there's a clarity and a sharpness and a precision to the spec highlights that just read China, but almost like a glaze over the China. It was a really nice render solution. And then, extreme close-ups you could get on that on her face, mm-hmm. and it just looked divine. And look, there is... on the website, a before and after, in addition to the video, where you can actually sort of see the porcelain doll that was the puppet one. And she had about 20 strings. There were two of them, one with 21 and one with 20 strings. But he actually built that himself, the puppeteer, or rather the model makers built the China girl. It was all wrong. He took it apart and then rebuilt it because as a craftsman, he makes his own puppets. And what you're ending up with is a pretty good approximation. It's not, like if you haven't seen these pictures, we're not talking about something that's sort of sometimes we have, cardboard cutouts or kind of like a blow-up kind of faked-out thing. This is something that really looks remarkably like the China girl, right down to that crazing, though, of course, she's got all these, small strings going through her and stuff, and the eyes and the mouth don't move. But it must have been spectacularly good lighting reference. But But Zap, it does draw out the point that you make, because if you look at the original with its lighting in the same situation as the one where, of course, the digital has gone in, the highlights don't match, because they have done hero Hollywood lighting on her to give it that, you know, eye light and everything else, that and cheek lighting that the real one didn't have. So the real one, in a sense, looks more documentary real. Though I do say in this particular case, in a film as bizarrely saturated as this is, I didn't give a rat's ass about inconsistencies in lighting on her, because I think she just looked so great that I just wanted more screen time with her.
I was just going to say, it looks interesting that looking at the specular highlights, they definitely dialed those up and down. When she was sat in bed talking to Oz, her face was a lot less glossy than it was in other shots. And I noticed that the crazing on her kind of changed slightly from shot to shot, though you'd kind of have to stare at it to notice. But they did dial it to change the personality or change the feel, which I thought was really interesting.
What were you going to say, Zeb?
I was just going to say a detail also back to the puppetry. I would love to have on this panel, you have now Matt and me, but I have a friend of mine named Trey Stokes, who actually is a puppeteer by trade originally. He was the guy who actually puppeted the underwater aliens in The Abyss.
Wow.
I would love to hear his kind of story on what he thought about this, actually.
Yeah, I've got to say, the other thing that's interesting from a technical point of view is you've got a character that shouldn't bend because she's porcelain. And you're exactly right. The puppet, which doesn't have any facial changes, gets a tremendous range of emotion just by tilts of heads and body language. Nevertheless, the animators did end up having to produce sort of smiles and lip sync and everything else on. And I think they did a really good job in keeping her looking porcelain-esque while still having to break the laws of a solid porcelain-type object and have it bend and stretch. At no point did I sort of feel like, okay, her hair looks like it's porcelain, but her face looks like rubber. Zap, I think there was a fine line to be walked there.
For sure. As you may recall, we talked about this very topic on the Doctor Who show. I was one with the ice governess thing, which was the exact same issue. And now this is more clearly a doll, so they can make the movements more doll-like for the rest. And I think they made it really subtle on, because we kind of buy cartoon eyes being like sort of on top of everything and can blink and stuff, while like the surrounding tissue or whatever doesn't really move because it's a little bit stylized. And I felt they were doing a little bit of that. And also the mouth, it was very localized to like the mouth moving, instead of if you wanted to try to do it more realistic, you would have the whole face moving. And I think they intentionally made it more like the mouth was moving and the eyes were moving to keep the porcelain and the doll character. And I bought it hook, line, and sinker. It was absolutely fantastic work.
Yeah, Matt, I would say that if you were to make a short film with China Girl in it, I would jump at it in a second. Like, there was nothing about her that wasn't magical on screen. She had a bit of kind of sassy attitude. She was playing it for comic effect, but she was incredibly moving when she was initially broken and hiding. I mean, that idea of a disabled girl, I actually found the China Girl more emotionally sort of charged as a disabled girl than the girl in the wheelchair in the live action sequence. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, definitely. And am I right in thinking that the girl in the wheelchair in the live action scene was the girl that played the voice for China Doll?
Okay, so now you're just going to...
okay,
I think not, actually.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I think that they did double up a lot of the actors between the two locations. And there are obviously references there to the first one, which we'll come back to. I just don't know in this particular case if that was the case. I don't think so, yeah.
I think I saw a picture of the person doing the voice, and it did not look the same. But I may have misunderstood that, so I plead don't know on that.
Now, that's another interesting aspect, because the person that's doing the voice performance on set, it's actually sort of like a double performance that's going on there, because Josie King is actually having to perform that voice while the puppeteer is having to act out that emotion at the same time as Sam Raimi is sort of reacting to effectively both as one, if that makes sense. And I think that's an interesting aspect, because you don't get that normally. Like, normally you get a voice actor off the side and somebody's standing in with a literally a soft toy kind of thing for eyeline. And so you don't really expect to get much emotion out of the soft toy. It just is an eyeline and everything's coming from the performance of the voice. But here there really was a duality of performance, because Josie needs to, and was seeing what the puppet was doing on a split, but she needs to, you know, time for his movements almost as much as he's timing for her delivery. And I think it's testament to the fact that that didn't get out of sync, that there wasn't any sense of the voice being a detached voice from the, you know, they really did lock in. I would not want to try and do that, work with somebody off to the side who's providing the voice for the character that I'm trying to move. I mean, it's a complex improv theater at best. And, you know, obviously Franco's trying to react to the character, but at least there he's got a sort of single eye line and he can sort of be listening. But I mean, man, that would have been really hard to make sure that your movements matched what the sort of thing she was doing. And the puppeteer is literally making her move, as you'll hear in that podcast, to breathe and to do a whole lot of things. And yeah, of course you can edit it later to tighten it up a little bit. Still, they had to work well in sync.
Yeah, I would guess they would do some editing, but I was actually surprised. I listened to the podcast where you did the interview, and that they were actually doing some, what you described, that they had the actress and the puppeteer kind of play off each other and have it work as well as it did. Of course, we haven't seen the unedited, so perhaps there are some pauses they take out or whatever, but it seemed to, whatever they did, it worked, because I really think that she is like the most engaging character in the movie.
Yep.
And if I want to see a sequel to this, I don't want it to be Oz. I want it to be Adventures of China Girl or something.
Yep, I agree.
But, yeah.
Totally agree. Now, let's compare that with Finley the Flying Monkey. So this is a character that they had a stand-in for. They had the same thing. They had Zach, who is delivering the lines. Somebody else is, and I'm not going to even use the word puppeteering. I'm going to sort of rotting or holding in an eyeline character. So it wasn't in any way an articulated performance, and then it gets replaced with the digital copy. So, and I should point out, for those that don't know, in both cases, they would shoot clean passes and passes where this puppeted or rotted in character was for eyeline, though invariably they'd end up, even though they'd want to use the clean pass, using the pass with the character because it might be a bit better, and having to digitally remove whatever was in shot to put in a negative space that can be then filled by the digital character. But do we feel that the monkey worked well or not, Zap?
Nowhere near as well. First, I think there was an issue of design. He kind of looked weird to me. I can't put my finger on it. It was like, for a monkey, I would expect a little bit more of a nose sticking out kind of thing. He looked very flat-faced. And it was something in the fur rendering which bugged me a bit, that I would kind of expect slightly more darker shadow in between the furs. It looks almost between every hair. It kind of looked like a lack of contrast somehow. Maybe it was completely accurate to some reference. I don't know, but to me he looked almost like a little bit undefined, where I would have expected more definition in the strands of fur. And as a character, he was, you know, I did not buy him anywhere near as well. Could be the writing too, the stuff he was made to say, etc., that the China girl got all the cool stuff to say. I don't know, but it didn't work as well for me.
I think this is my problem, and I think it's okay to criticize, and we always say this on the show, criticize as long as you can articulate what you would do. So I would say that I agree with you, and what I would suggest is this felt like a character that had been shrunk down rather than a character that was naturally small. So, and I don't know if this is true, but it felt to me that the proportions of the limbs were more that of, you know, when you get an adult actor, you've got them to try and play a child, all those ratios of limbs to body to head are all wrong. Well, this felt like it had more kind of an adult ratio of limbs to head than a smaller character. Like, I'm used to a smaller character, especially if it's a monkey, having like longer arms and the kind of smaller leg thing that you get from a chimp. Now, again, I might be not referencing the right monkey, but I buy in completely to your point on the fur, because that's another thing that made it feel like it had been scaled down. When you saw the character, they had such super fine hair that it was almost like a fuzz, and it felt like it was sort of like the right scale for the character, but at that scale, I would expect, of size of character, I'd expect coarser hair, and especially around the face. And then the net effect of that meant that it just looked kind of like it was an older man, an older male, and an older male that was adult, shrunk, if that makes sense, in monkey form, rather than a kind of either a younger monkey or a older monkey or even just a small monkey. There was just my depth cues on the fur and then the scale of the limbs to the torso, to the head, to the eyes. I mean, bigger eyes would have been a cheat maybe from a cutesy point of view, but, you know, smaller monkeys have big eyes. I don't know. Matt, what do you think?
I would agree with both of you. It felt to me like the performance and the personality of the monkey was much more like a child, and yet when you look at it, it looked much more, as you said, like an older person.
Yeah.
The fur again looked odd. The wings I didn't mind so much, and the rendering on the clothes were really nice, the kind of velvet hat and top, but just some of the ways that he moved and some of the ways that he performed just didn't quite sit right. I was watching a lot of the time because he was lugging that big bag around a lot of the time at the beginning and just trying to ascertain whether I was happy with just the weight that he was having to carry around and whether that looked right. And it looked great in a lot of shots, and in a couple of shots when he was dragging it along the ground, it felt like they had suddenly made the bag much lighter than it was originally. And there were just a few things that bothered me slightly. That
See,
was all.
I think even on the clothes, and I didn't think of it until you said it then, but the clothes had a weave and stiffness that made me again think that it was a larger scale cloth scaled down to fit in the shot. Like, I almost expect a thickness and a stiffness to small character outfits because the weave does size, you know, sort of doesn't change. So it's, if it's the same material as it is, which it obviously isn't because one's from Oz and one isn't, but if Oz's coat has got the same weave density as his jacket, then his jacket is going to appear stiffer because it's like a small cutout of it, which is why, you know, dolls' clothes have to be super fine to give him bend. Everything about his sleeves in particular just seemed to bend like if he was a much bigger character. I don't know. It just, China doll seemed right in the fabric, but now you mention it, I think that it wasn't that he was a disaster, but he just wasn't as successful is probably the way I describe it.
Yeah, I mean, the China girl was clearly upstaging him in many departments. I'm not sure. It might be my memory is slightly different. I didn't have so much problem with the cloth. I actually felt it did have a little bit of the stiffness that you are talking about. And the limb proportions were kind of half and half between what you say and maybe what they should have been. The very tiny eyes, though, might be, and the kind of no nose at all thing. When I think of a monkey, they have different proportions in the face. So I think that was disturbing me. And then the character itself, like the whatever he was given to say and do, was, you know, not as engaging.
Yeah, I mean, we're probably heavily influenced by a chimp, which has that really distinctive eyebrow that he didn't have. You know, like it has that kind of, it sort of protrudes out, it goes over in a convex way, where he kind of had eyebrows that came down more like a person's eyebrows, closer to his face. But it didn't matter, like the ears were kind of, it felt like lower and smaller, and the face just all had the proportions of, I thought, like an older man, not a young or even sort of smaller monkey. Now, again, they did reference a particular monkey, so you could probably say, okay, it's accurate to what they were referencing. I just think maybe they picked the wrong monkey to reference to, or the director took them in the direction. I'm not saying that it was mathematically wrong if that's what the director wanted, but I would have probably, pushed for a different design. And, you know, this is 2020 hindsight. Look, the thing that was more successful, wasn't as successful as China Girl, but it was pretty successful, was some of the, I thought, environments. And yet some of the environments kind of bugged me. So I'm going to see if I can go around you guys and see where you sit on this. Some environments to me were just stupidly saturated, ridiculously kind of plastic and odd. Now, a couple I know reference the feature, and we're going to get to that next, but I don't know, they just felt bizarrely set-like. And then some of the environments were fantastical and gorgeous. I'm thinking now in the bubble travel sequence. So is that, what did you think? Did you like the environments or not?
That's a definitely a mixed bag for me. And I'm kind of wondering if there is not an element of homage to the original movie, because if you look at how plasticky those things were, they were literally plastic in a very small confined set in some cases. So maybe it's, you know, amount of that. But what most bugged me of environment, though, was, you know, this thing is in 3D and they have to throw in this ride element all the time. We were flowing down waterfalls that were, by the way, beautifully rendered, and the fluid sims are apparently super fantastic and everything. But those kind of sequences just bug me no end. I just can't stand them, basically. So that annoyed me. Then we get into this, you know, show and tell with the little strange flowers that open themselves, and they were beautiful and looked nicely rendered, super saturated, as you said, but it was kind of a little bit, what's the point, just to show how weird Oz is, okay. But I mean, there were other environment, as you say, the bubble flight sequence, although I, interestingly, as the computer graphics nerd, I do have an issue with the refraction of light through the bubbles. Bubbles are super thin. For refraction to occur, you have to travel through a medium, and these bubbles were crazy refracting the background, and bubbles simply don't do that unless they fill them with some gas with a different index of refraction, which I doubt, because you wouldn't be able to breathe it. But while they were flying around there, there was a bunch of stuff in the environment which I kind of bought much more. I say maybe we get to that later, but Emerald City itself, if we want to take that as an environment, when they see it at a distance, that read to me like super matte painting, almost 2D. And again, maybe this is an homage, because if you look at the original movie, it's clearly it's a painting and it's very 2D. But is it supposed to look like actual emeralds, or is it just Emerald City because it's green? That's not clear to me. It was supposed to be actual emeralds, then there was, you know, failed. They flew by, in the bubble sequence, they flew by a couple of things that might look a little bit like some emeralds, but these, I will actually have the opposite problem with the bubbles. They were too little refractive. You could see through them, sort of, with a little offset, and with big, thick, glossy things like that, you don't. You see just massively refracted weirdness in them. So I don't know.
What's your position on the environments there, Matt?
I am probably going to come from the other direction, that I mainly really like them. When you first arrive and you go from that square to widescreen kind of pull across, and everything goes color, it immediately felt to me kind of like Alice in Wonderland versus the Grinch versus maybe some Avatar thrown in there. And I thought, let's see where this is going to go. And it's obviously the same production designer. It's Robert Stromberg, isn't it, for the production
designer? Yeah, Robert Stromberg. What a guy. Yeah.
Phenomenal. So I thought, exactly. I thought it's bound to be great with his name attached to it. And overall, I really liked it. I did see it in 3D, and I definitely agree with what Zach was saying with regards to that whole kind of ride down the waterfall at the beginning. But I actually really enjoyed that. And once you got down to the river and the water rendering looked fantastic, I loved all the kind of iridescent plants and kind of almost the subsurface that was coming off petals and leaves and things. So it was super saturated, but I felt it just worked really well for that sequence. And then the bubble ride, again, that whole sequence looked amazing to me, especially once they got down to the kind of plants and kind of weird, almost Superman-esque kind of spiky kind of rock formations, the green formations, and all that was obviously crystalline. So I liked it, and the bubbles themselves, as Zap said, they did have a slightly unusual kind of refractive property, but I thought they'd worked really hard to get that kind of oily surface to them that you would expect to see if you kind of do bubbles with washing up liquid with your kids. You see that kind of light movement over the surface due to the oil, and I thought they'd really nailed that well.
Sepp, is there a technical name that's escaping me for that oil-like property of on the...
There is, and it's kind of escaping something iridescent or some. I don't remember.
I think, yeah, there's an actual term for it.
What happens is you get, in a really thin film, you get the light is actually bouncing back and forth and interacting with itself, which means that you get like a comb filter effect where some frequencies of light are attenuated and some gets emphasized. And depending on the thickness, this changes around. So as the thickness of the bubble slightly varies, you get this little rainbows floating around, and it's quite beautiful.
Yeah, I have read a research paper on that, and there is a technical name for it. I apologize, I can't remember what it is. For me, the bubble sequence is is everything about the environments for me. The volumetrics and the clouds are u-beaut magnificent. I mean, there's just no question about it. They just are optically wonderful. Now, they're very stylized, but hey, that's the film. And they're very, magic hour lit, but that's the film. So I think that's just, without a doubt, awesome. For me, the green emeralds and especially the red flowers that come out in that are just incredibly wrong. I mean, I don't know why they're wrong, but they're just wrong. They just look set piecey and CG, and just generally I don't like them much at all. I don't know if it's because I expect them to be more glass-like and they seem quite opaque, the flowers, or they're just so ridiculously saturated as to be unbelievable. It's probably that. I mean, you've got James Franco just not as saturated as the flowers, so that's probably really bugging me. But then they come out of the emerald thing and you've got, The Wizard of Oz meets King Kong meets, sort of, I don't know what. And you've got this wonderful kind of elephant waterfall. So you've got great particle system stuff. You've got great optics. You've got great lion mountains. You know, tons of depth in the scene. I just love it to death. So for me, you sort of go through all of the phases of stuff there. Because I think the effects rendering in this is spectacularly good. I mean, the various magical puffs of stuff that come up look awesome at enormous production value, and the environments, when having that kind of fantasy-esque thing, I can sort of forgive the skies being that blue from horizon line to the top of the sky dome, but man, that's just those emerald flowers and stuff just go ridiculously green.
And one thing that bugs me in this whole fly-through around thing, I don't know if this is just me, but I have a problem when the movie is in 3D and they incessantly have the convergence plane at the focus point, which means that basically the scale of your scene keeps changing. We're kind of used to that in 2D where, the face of the actor in a close-up is obviously way taller than the same actor in a wide shot. But when they in 3D keep the same convergence for that, the feeling I get is that the scale of things keep changing. So in the long shots, they're actually really tiny and everything looks really tiny instead of far away. And in the close-up, they look really big. And that is kind of disturbing me. And I wish they should move away from this incessance of locking the convergence to the depth of the screen the whole time, and let a bit more space into the scene, because I think this is the kind of movie where you want to show a massive vista that actually looks big, and it never really does that because they always cheat on the convergence and want to converge on something.
Yeah, and I mean, the stuff that's that far away in the distance is going to be basically with very little parallax, and so it should read very differently than the way that it does. My big problem is not in this sequence isn't that at all. My big problem is in the opening section, you have all these live action actors that are in bubbles that are completely lit from behind and yet are super front lit inside their bubbles. Now they're not front lit in the sense that the sun is directly hitting them from the front, but man, there's some massive bounce going into the front of these actors to get them that lit up. If you were trying to film an actor, you know, with the sun almost going straight down the barrel of the lens and they're coming towards you, they would be silhouette. When she first comes out of the clouds and comes towards you, or they all come towards you, you know, all of the characters are just ridiculously lit and evenly lit as they spin around, and now you see them lit front on. I mean, it's like there is a sort of a sense of they've been kind of lit from behind a little, but generally speaking, you've almost got them in a completely non-matching comp environment, and that's vastly worse for me than what's going on with the 3D. But I guess I'm the 2D guy, right? You guys weren't bugged by that?
Well, now that you mention it, yeah, that was kind of perhaps, but that was not a thing. I mean, that's so common in movies that there's someone is standing just off camera with a bounce card, which wouldn't be there in reality. I really love more documentary style lighting, and I wish there was more contrast in movies in general to allow things to go to black and allow things to overexpose a little more. But I mean, this is the kind of movie which has this compressed dynamic range kind of stylized look. So I was probably too forgiving and nice in that regard. So it didn't bug me that much.
I mean, I can sort of forgive it if you've got a sequence. I mean, I thought it was gorgeous when he drops down first in the balloon through the, you know, waterfalls, not from a technical rendering point of view, like the waterfalls were great and stuff. And his lighting there was, you know, more even than it should have been, but it wasn't really that harsh because we weren't sort of looking straight into the sun. They come out of the bubbles for the first time, they go right into the sun. I mean, the sun is like completely behind them and yet they're super front lit. Anyway, hey, I've been putting this off for a while, so let's discuss the link to the original film. So these bubbles came from that, right? They're in the first film. It didn't look anything like this, but there was a bubble that had a witch in it. And if you took that and stretched it a bit and made it look like the sort of thing that you do in your backyard mat with your kids, this is what you'd end up with. But I'd read before I went in that they weren't allowed to hit on anything from the original film because they were going to the source material, and under the deal of that was negotiated for the production of the film, anything that was in the books they were allowed to use, anything that was in the film, like the ruby slippers, that was all a construction from the film, hence was off limits for the filmmakers to include in this film. But the bubble,
so wait, are you telling me that the first chapter of the book is in black and white and the rest of the book is in color?
I don't think
that's clearly taken from the original.
Absolutely,
movie.
But yet I figure that that's something that they were just allowed to do because you couldn't really stop them going black and white and color. That's probably something. But I mean, I asked the filmmakers about it and they denied it. But there have been reports that they had arguments over the color of green that the Wicked Witch could become, not to match. But certainly the ruby slippers, the whole sort of things that would come from the book, they were allowed, but absolutely we spoke to the filmmakers about it directly, and things that weren't, that had just come from the original Oz, were completely off limits. So they were just things they couldn't include. Now, but the bubbles were in the film, but also they must have been in the book somehow or other because they were allowed to do this bubble thing. And there were other things like that. Now, the Emerald City, I think, is a nod to that style of filmmaking, though I think it's not meant to be a mathematical match. But there are all sorts of stuff in there. If you've gone back, I think you have, Zap, looked at the end of the original Wizard of Oz. I'm just sort of stunned by the number of references that I found that they'd picked up on in this film that were references to the first one, not least of which, of course, was that big face that the wizard has for the whole he's behind the man behind the curtain. So clearly there was...
Yeah, and I mean, I'm surprised you're telling me. I would guess, though, what you're saying is they couldn't pick story points because there's a copyright for stories. We all know, like, you know, there's different copyright for imagery and different copyrights for stories. And there, when you have music, there's a copyright for the lyrics and the sounds and the notes and the blah, blah, blah. And then for the recording, et cetera, et cetera. So it could be something like that. So they couldn't say ruby slippers because it's actually silver slippers in the book.
Right.
So it's a story point. different, but they could homage the look, because the kind of throne roomy thing where they put in this yep. You know, contraption with the head smoke and projecting into it, which by the way didn't look anything like what it actually looks when you project into smoke. Sadly, totally not didn't work, but. It was very similar, and it was at least like taking every like inspiration from the original possible. I haven't, you know, side by side looked if they were actually identical. And even like the gag, you know, with going from black and white to color, for which, by the way, there's a really interesting VFX thing about the original movie. You know, the beginning is like in the sepia toned yep. color, and in this one shot where Dorothy is walking out into the colored world,
yep.
they solve this by sepia painting the set and having a stand-in girl sepia dressed that goes up to the door first. The camera passes her, and then the actual Dorothy in full color walks past the camera and into the color scene, which is kind of a neat, you know, low-tech 1939 style trick of solving these problems. It was in this movie, it was more like we simply faded to color. I was kind of surprised they didn't make something more, you know, elaborate than that. It was almost more elaborate in 39 than now, which kind of surprised me.
Yeah, I've got to say that is one of my favorite pieces of that original film. I think that is a spectacular. I mean, that and the tornado, which I think from a visual effects, I guess it was special effects back then, point of view, just really great work. But that sepia tone transition, which I did know about, is magnificent.
And what surprised me is that the tornado in this movie is surprisingly unspectacular. It's 2013. You should be able to do raging tornadoes in ways that is utterly amazing. And it still is lost nowhere near us. I had really set, let's see this twister now. And I was underwhelmed.
Yeah. You know what I found when I was watching the original? There were so many lines in it. It was like watching, you ever watched a Shakespearean play and you almost feel like going, hey, Shakespeare ripped off, oh wait, it was a Shakespeare original line. And you get that all the time, right? There's so many sort of phrases in the English language pulled from Shakespeare. There were so many like, you know, oh, I'm melting and the man behind the curtain and just tons of stuff that I just realized, oh, of course, this all came, you know, we're not in Kansas anymore. It's all Wizard of Oz. And it made, it kind of underlined how memorable that original film was, that and the music. And unfortunately, if you see the original back to back with this one, it does kind of make the new one pale a bit, because the original deservedly has gone into film history as a, you know, kind of a landmark film for good reason. I mean, everything about that film is not perfect, but there's so much in it that's magnificent that, you know, it just, watching it again, you just reminded, oh my God, all these sort of little things that I reference in popular culture started here. Matt, let me ask you the nature of that transition and the tornado and stuff. Did you feel robbed at all? Because that was a sequence all shot in color. And I might add, they did all the visual effects out to the full width. So it's happening under those borders. So it was shot on the red camera in stereo, and if they had a tornado and it was being cut by that 4x3 frame, it's all the way out to the edge in case that 4x3 wasn't there. God knows why they did that, but I'd feel bad for the road artists that did it. But anyway, did you feel ripped off when we went from either black and white to colour or saw the tornado?
The black and white to colour, I did feel a little bit ripped off. I didn't know what to expect, but I hoped more than a cross dissolve would be something they would be doing. I don't know what would be the right thing to do there. Maybe something that was more organic than just fading from one to the other, or maybe the world became.
What about going somewhere from 2D to 3D would have been kind of cool?
Yeah, yeah, Tron that would style. Have been nice. Yeah, yep. Definitely that would have been nice. With regards to the tornadoes, we've obviously seen them back in Twister, back of the original CG tornado, and then Day After Tomorrow also had tornadoes in for quite a number of sections. This one, although it didn't look completely spectacular, I thought from the wide shot when it was still black and white, that looked really nice. But once you got inside it, I was hoping to see a lot more kind of debris flying around and things. And although there did seem to be things in the sim kind of bouncing off each other and things were breaking and cracking, it felt like if he was in the middle of something this big and angry, there would be a much greater number of things going on, and it just, as Zappa said, just seemed a little bit flat.
So you wanted a cow flying by?
I would love to have seen a cow. That would have been great.
Yeah, so the Tornado in the original movie is kind of, I mean, when it's done in the distance, it's completely amazing. And apparently that's like a sock puppet or something. I don't know. It looks completely realistic, and they have so much wind on set, which seems to work just fine.
Yeah, it was a
then, of course,
stocking.
She bangs her head, and then it goes into crazy land, because in the movie it's kind of a dream sequence. So you have the cows and whatever. This movie treated that differently, but I agree with Matt. I mean, I expected kind of more stuff, perhaps, and more 3D out of this tornado. The tornado in the title sequence, which we might get to later, was more, you know, had more depth than this one.
Okay, well, there are a bunch of other visual effects we should cover. So before we get to the title sequence, let's knock out some of those. Were there any other sequences that, Matt, you really liked in Oz? Because there's a battle sequence, the fireworks, the various things that the witches throw at each other and zap each other with.
One of the things that I really liked was the kind of the fog that I think it was...
The good witch does with the army?
Yeah, that goes over the poppy field, and then she does earlier again with the army, and then the monkeys
coming. At the graveyard.
Yeah, yeah, I just thought that looked spectacular, rendered really nicely, and just looked really thick and something you could really get lost in.
So if this was all rendered in Arnold, Arnold seems to be really making quite a lot of inroads at the high end. What's your take on that?
Yeah, that's fantastic. Arnold is making leaps and bounds into all sorts of rendering. And I think, to me, though, what's kind of more important than Arnold per se is the fact that physically based rendering is coming really strong. We're no longer in this era where you light with 5011 handmade bounce lights and all that craziness. You basically let the rules of physics to a larger extent dictate stuff and do quite a lot of less kind of tweak. Well, you still do tweaking in post for art's sake, but the era of you rendering a bunch of kind of disconnected passes and then kind of randomly toss them together and try to by eye tweak it in post to hopefully get something pretty is hopefully kind of over. And the real physical rendering, which gives you like gets you 90% of the way there straight out of the gate, and where you then sprinkle the art on top, I think that is a clear trend. And since Arnold is a tool that does precisely that, no surprise that Arnold is seen a lot these days.
Yeah. I think the quality, as you say, of the physically based lighting, if you accept that you inherit all of the limitations of sort of real lighting as well, in the fact that it doesn't get you around my problem before of that, you know, if you just light incorrectly for the scene for a comp, then it's going to be an incorrectly lit, perfectly lit scene, if that makes sense. But yeah, I think it's really producing that and very, very good fluid sims and particle sims is producing immense production value. And I don't think you've got any excuses now. It's really a combination of art direction and animation, because there hasn't been anywhere near the same leaps and bounds in, say, animation as we've seen in some of the other aspects of 3D. It's improved and it's got better. Obviously, it's got dramatically better, but it feels like rendering's just really come along a lot in the last, maybe 5 years? I don't know. What do you think, Sam?
Yeah, I agree, actually. And it's interesting with animation because there is, you know, a lot of work in animation to do more like muscle simulations and that yep. stuff and for skin sliding and all this stuff. The problem there is that while you can do all this, in reality, it's the muscles that are driving the bone and then you have the skin kind of sliding on top. It's really hard to hit an actual pose that way by basically, you know, tensing muscles. So you have to like pose your character and then it'll kind of work it out backwards. So what would the muscle motions had to be to actually get this person into this position based on the speed of movement and wherever. And that's an area which I feel we're maybe not there completely yet. And also the fact, like, stuff like the facial expression, the animator won't take like the eyebrow and move it, whereas in reality there's a bunch of muscles somewhere that's actually pulling the eyebrow up, but the kind of control the animator want to put on it is not really the control that Mother Nature puts into your face or your arms when you move them, and it's really hard for the animator to use the different kind of thing. Now in rendering, it has become easier, because I think the problem is actually harder for animation, because in rendering, at least it's light, and we can say, I want a light from here, and you kind of get the physically correct effect. But for animation, I think it's a more difficult problem to solve, to have the same kind of... but I think there might be some interesting developments going on.
We spoke to Bill Westerhofer, Life of Pi, about this, and he made that point, because we'd done a lot of stuff on that muscle system in, say, The Hobbit, where you're absolutely right. You move the limbs and the inverse kinematics, and you've got a skeleton that basically drives a very great number of sort of flesh sims that give you this great muscle, fat, and skin properties. And he was saying, well, the tiger needed to flex its muscles before it pounced, not pounce and then have muscles that were flexing as a result. And so, I think he illuminated that point to me very, very well. I certainly opened my eyes to thinking about those issues. And it's a really difficult problem, because it's
the muscles always have to lead the move. And I must say, Life of Pi really did that extremely well. But the muscle have to tense first before you can move. And to have the animator think of... Because it's the same thing, you know, our brains are so attuned to seeing these things, but still not really understanding them. So because we, you know, our brain filters it out. It's perception again. So you have to really think about, okay, what would it entail for this tiger to jump from here to there? Which, by the way, no cat I ever saw had a problem jumping up this tiny distance that this canvas was covering on the boat. But story point. Yeah.
Okay, but you will agree with me that there's a good reason why Life of Pi won the VFX Oscar.
Absolutely.
Because they did get that that skin on the and the muscle stuff working, both in terms of a still frame and in terms of over time. In other words, they did both the temporal stuff and the spatial stuff really, really well in that muscle system.
There's two shots in there there's one where it grabs with the claws, and you can really see where the muscles between the claws contract, which was absolutely fantastic. And also near the end, when it's really, you know, starving and the skin is kind of hanging, it's fantastic work. Well-deserved visual effects Oscar for sure.
So, Matt, in this world that we're in, anything that stood out for you that you really hated? I mean, I said I didn't like I loved the bubble sequence in some respects, but it had everything I loved and hated in the film. What about you? Was there anything you didn't like in the film from a technical point of view?
There was two pieces of animation that really stood out to me as just being, what the heck is happening there? And it may have been purposely done. The first one was when Oz and Finley were leaving the castle and going down the Yellow Brick Road before they got to China Doll's town. There were some horses in a paddock.
Oh, yeah. What the heck was that about?
I thought, have they just been made to be mechanical horses or something? They were just very...
Well, no, they were sliding, I reckon, on the background.
Yeah, I just don't know what was happening. So that really took me out of the movie.
I've seen that twice, and the film twice, and I've seen both times. I looked at it the second time to think they may have been mechanical horses, or they were wearing something weird. I mean, I couldn't really make it out, but the motion was wrong. I totally agree. Relative to the ground, I swear one of them, the one that's more camera left, that's facing camera right, is sliding. Yeah.
Yeah. And can I throw in one more?
Yeah, sure.
There was also a scene just before, when in fact it was right before the bubble sequence where they jumped off the cliff, where he ran to the end of this kind of nose-like cliff, and then there was a wide shot.
The silhouette?
Kind of, what was that?
The silhouette of him almost overbalancing?
Stop-motion-y,
the slapsticky,
coyote.
Yeah, it looked like someone had just passed it on. Yeah.
It was like, insert digital double here. Now let's animate in a stylized fashion. Go back to live action again.
Right, yeah.
I'm so glad you brought that up. I had noted it in the cinema and I'd forgotten to mention it. No, really good call. I was like, that took me completely out of the film as well. It could have been a deliberate, like, let's get it kind of stylized. The trouble is it just felt like we'd just switched to a digital character and back again in a way that you don't want the audience to think.
Right.
Zap, anything else that sort of bothered you?
Well, there is one thing that bothers me. It's not so much the effects per se, because they were fine, but something that bugs me in almost every movie where magic is involved is magic battles. Because since Harry Potter and stuff, it's become that magic battle apparently is about sparkling stuff on each other. It's not about magic. The only really good magic battle I've seen, and it's still kind of kitschy, it's actually Boris Karloff and Vincent Price from the 1963 movie The Raven. They do an actual magic battle, which is actually magic. So the guy, one guy throws his staff on the other guy, which turns into a snake and wraps around his neck. So the other guy turns the snake into a scarf and just takes it off and stuff like that. That's an actual magic battle where they use the magic power to actually perform magic on each other. They, you know, he conjures up a cannon, which shoots a cannonball on the guy and the other deflects it, etc. But here is just shoot the sparkly stuff. I'm so annoyed in Harry Potter where they stand there and just shoot the wavy sparkly stuff at each other. That is not a magic battle.
I have two daughters that would, you know, take you to task that wasn't a magic battle, but I do take your point. And
but that's not an effect. So for an effect that was problematic for me, something people like to do is this breaking the frame trick. They did it in Life of Pi, and they did it here in the 4:3 sequence. It was snowing into the screen, kind of.
Yeah.
I actually kind of like that. The snowing into the screen worked, but there was another one earlier. What was that? Well, it was something else that was basically thrown outside the 4:3, which was just annoying for some reason. Yet another 3D gimmicky thing. I bought the snowflakes for some reason. They were fine, but the other thing for which I can't remember what it was, but it was another frame breaking thing.
The embers, like, when they're doing the dance?
No, there was something being. I think it was something the strongman was throwing after him when he was entering the building. Yeah, it was probably the hat. It was something being thrown, and it was that annoyed me. But it's more, and it was probably not the quality of the thing. It was just the fact that he did the thing. It was like one thing too many to do like that.
I don't want to sound like I think the visual effects in this film were bad, because I don't actually think they're bad. I think there's some magnificent work in this film. It really is great. And that's why I think we started with China Girl. The thing is that China Girl set the bar so high that other stuff that, you know, I might have been a little more... I mean, if you can do that, you could jolly well do something over here. I know you can do it better because, look, you just did China Girl so well. I would hate it to come off as if the show was saying that the visual effects were bad. There are just a few things that... There are a couple of shots, I think, that actually didn't work properly. There's one, as I say, that horse. I'm sure it's quite convinced that's an error. But, there's a couple of things that I didn't agree with the design on, like personally, like the monkey. I don't think that it was a bad visual effect so much as I just didn't like the monkey design. But, you know, I haven't won multiple Academy Awards for production design and stuff, so, you know, who am I to say? I think there was some... That and the effects animation work, the cloud stuff, the magical smoke stuff, was really exquisite, and there was some fabulous environments stuff rendered in this. But unfortunately, the film wasn't strong enough that if for any reason the visual effects weren't up to par, I wasn't that engaged that I was willing to cut the film any slack. I was just taken out of it. I think if you had a super engaging story, maybe if you had Judy Garland in there, you know, you've got just enough love of a character that you can forgive a lot of sins, whereas if it's not really an engaging story, your eye sort of wanders and you start becoming more critical in one sense, or at least less forgiving in another. And look, also, I want to point out that I have some major problems with, or not major problems, I have some ethical problems, I guess, with the original Wizard of Oz. There were some pretty crappy things done, or a couple of crappy things done in that original first film, and And certainly there were some things behind the scenes. I know the guys that were playing the Munchkins were paid like $50 a week. They even paid Toto the dog $125 a week. So it was like, you know, it wasn't like we're holding that up as an example of that back in the 30s they did it right. But nevertheless, it has so much going for it, that and the performances by today's standards are kind of over the top, but I still find it in an enchanting film. And unfortunately, same thing applies, right? You put an enchanting film up that's dovetailing so closely with a film like this, it becomes, you know, even if you don't watch Wizard of Oz, you just remember it as being really good. And I think that also affects you in the cinema. But Matt, you said your kids went and they just liked this because they probably had no reference to the original Wizard of Oz.
I don't know whether Emily's seen it at all. She must have done it at some point, but yeah, she was definitely coming at this from a fresh new set of eyes and liked it.
I mean, it's not as if the Tin Man was a particularly believable costume, was it, Ola Zapp?
No, and apparently the first guy who was supposed to play Tin Man almost died by the aluminum powder they were powdering him with, so he ended up in an iron lung. So it's actually the second actor that we see in the original movie. By the way, connections to the original movie, was I the only one who thought that this lion that came and attacked him, that he threw some magic ball on and that scared away, will be what becomes the Cowardly Lion in the actual Oz?
That's what that was. I just dismissed that as being an odd moment.
Yeah, but it looked really scared afterwards. I don't know. References.
Yeah, I'm sure that is exactly what it was. You're a cleverer man than I. I didn't get that.
I tell you what, with that line though, someone went to a lot of love to make that look nice and it only got used that one time, which was a shame.
That's true. Yeah. It did look nice. Okay, so in summing it up, this was not really being able to hold a candle, I think, to the original. And it suffered because we just love, even if we don't see it side by side, we still love the kind of whole Over the Rainbow, Judy Garland, World of Oz so much. This was a fine film and completely adequate in many respects, and it's spectacularly good in some visual effects and odd in others. I still can't get past the super saturated grade, but that's just me. But yeah, I think that would be where I'd sum it up. Zap, is that...
Are we going to mention the title sequence? Because I thought that was kind of interesting because it was a throwback to there is apparently an traditional animation technique that is like that, where you make shows like that with basically cards that was done back in the olden days. And I think it was kind of a cool throwback to that. I think maybe it was me or something that they had almost over-exaggerated the 3D depth on it, which was one of these things that happened, that the twister in that was in the title cards was actually kind of more impressive and had more depth than the twister in the actual movie for some reason. But I thought it was kind of a cool thing, although similar has been seen before. I kind of enjoyed the title sequence and give it a thumbs up.
Yeah, I mean, it exists in that black and white world, so it's a much more design-led piece than anything else. The company that did that is... it's a really good design company. I'm going to get it wrong. Hang on. I'll try and look it up while we're speaking. They've done an... I mean, it's a very well-known design company. And I've
is
kind
of... Is it YU&Co?
Yes. Thank you. Yes. I was spacing out. We actually a bit split in the office over this, actually, because some people thought it was spectacularly good and others were like, yeah, sort of didn't bite with them. So it's interesting that you brought that up.
Yeah, we've seen the Tintin title, the thing that having like a 3D scape flying through its title sequence has been done a lot. Like, you know, the Spider-Man title sequence is like the titles are kind of hanging in 3D space and you're flying around it. The Tintin opening sequence was kind of very similar to this. But just this, what I liked with it was more that the stylized, they actually made it look, the things were really on sticks coming in, so it was kind of like a little puppetry of text that could perhaps almost actually work to be performed in reality, although it would be mechanically very, very complicated. So that's kind of what I liked about that.
Yeah, yeah. I'm probably falling, I probably wouldn't have gone to the titles. There are such strong titles around these days. These were definitely solid, but, you know, in the pantheon of amazing title work that really blew my socks, it felt appropriately retro, but it didn't particularly resonate with me. I don't know why that is. Matt, what about you?
I saw the movie twice, and when it came on the second time, I was, oh yeah, I'd forgotten that they were there, but then enjoyed them. So probably similar to you in that they were nice to watch, but I forgot about them within 10 minutes of the film following on.
Yeah, there are some films that the titles just completely disjoint. I swear every time I've seen, when it's come on TV, the film Speed, I am convinced that that's a title sequence that I never saw before. It just seems completely disconnected from the film. Came on last night. I know in this title sequence, because I just looked it up and I was trying to find out, they used 37 different types of fonts, which is pretty impressive, really, given that the golden rule of fonts in titles is to not use 37 different fonts. Okay, well, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you guys so much for being on the show. It really was a pleasure to talk to you about it. Zap, where people can go to find you or hook up with you on Twitter or whatever?
You can always find me on the Twitter thing. MasterZap is my Twitter handle. Or if you just Google Zap Anderson, I'm completely unmissable.
That is true. And how's the kitchen remodeling been going?
It's going sufficiently well.
Can I just say that I was really impressed that you not only had one time-lapse of your kitchen being remodeled, but multiple cutaway time-lapses, including outside of people delivering the goods. Impressive use of title sequences.
I actually just turned the camera out the window, so it was not very high-tech there. Yeah, so there's a time-lapse of me remodeling my kitchen. That can be hashtag kitchenpocalypse on Twitter.
And Matt, you had any kitchen apocalypses in your kind of neck of the woods?
No, it's all pretty relaxed here, which is good. But if anyone wants to follow me, the best place is probably on the Twitters as Matt D. Leonard.
Brilliant. Well, thank you guys so much for being with us on the show. We've got a bunch of really good stuff coming up. We're entering into that sequence of pre-blockbusters, which will get us wound up in the middle of the year. Already we're starting to get stuff coming in for the great flood of films that are going to be coming down the pipe from Iron Man 3 to Superman. All of them will be here on the VFX show with our panel of experts. Thank you so much for being with us, and thank you guys for hosting this week. Until next time, I'm Mike Seymour. Thanks, guys. See you.
If you have any questions or comments, please email us at vfx@fxguide.com. Copyright 2012, FX Guide, LLC.